The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events Office, and tonight it is my great honor to introduce Malcolm Nance. A world-renowned counterterrorism expert and former career intelligence officer who is deployed in the Balkans, the Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa, Malcolm Nance is a longtime consultant for the U.S. government's special operations and homeland security agencies. His New York Times best-selling books include The Plot to Hack America, Hacking ISIS, The Plot to Betray America, and Defeating ISIS. The founder and executive director of the think tank Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideologies, he is a frequent commentator on MSNBC, and yes, he is very recently back from Ukraine. He joins us tonight with his latest book, They Want to Kill Americans: The Militias, Terrorists, and Deranged Ideology of the Trump Insurgency. That title pretty much offers you the broad scope thesis, I think. Not too much to say, but just to clarify, it describes the very real dangers. Yeah, no hedging on titles these days. It describes the very real dangers posed by the former president, his collaborators, and their followers by describing a terrifyingly plausible scenario in which a series of armed confrontations could bring about, I hate these words, a Trump dictatorship. One review calls it a scathing look at the MAGA crowd and the existential threat they pose to American democracy, and a stark warning to be taken seriously. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Mark Lamont Hill, a frequent guest here on our stage and interviewer. He is the Steve Charles Chair in Media, Cities and Solutions at Temple University, the host of BET News and the Coffee and Books podcast. He's a recipient of honors from the National Association of Black Journalists, GLAAD, and the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences. He's also the author of six books, including Beats, Rhymes, and Classroom Life, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, From Ferguson to Flint and Beyond, and Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Malcolm Nance and Mark Lamont Hill.
Good evening, everybody. This is what a beautiful crowd. Malcolm?
You know I'm from Philadelphia. When did they put this auditorium in? When I was in high school, we were not allowed to see this part of the library. I'm really shocked.
So this is a great venue and a great space to talk about this amazing book that you wrote. I want to start by saying I've read this book and I'm terrified. I'm absolutely terrified.
Yeah, that's about right.
I always begin with the question, a very simple question: why this book? Why now?
Well, that's a very good question, and here's where you're going to be a little bit even more surprised. That book was finished a year ago. And you know, there's a giant printer shortage in the world because several of the largest printing houses in China went down. Yeah. And they came to me last August and they were like, okay, we've got your publication date. I was like, great, January 6th, right? And I go, July 12th, 2022. Right. And I'm like, the story will hold up. I started this book in August of 2020. And what I was seeing was a follow-on to some of the writing that I had done in a previous book about Trump and the Trump-Russia scandal. Last book was called Plot to Betray America. And what I saw was that the people who were involved in Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis, the neo-Confederates, the some of these smaller militias, the Patriot Front, you know, after Charlottesville, everyone, they'd sort of disappeared throughout all of the rest of 2018 and 2019. They just went away, and you didn't see them out protesting. You didn't see the Boogaloo Boys in their camouflage or their Hawaiian shirts and all of that stuff. People thought that they really had gotten chased and had gone. Yeah. And what I noticed was by summer of 2020, the George Floyd summer, they had come back. But they were inside of massive crowds of armed men and women who weren't part of the Oath Keepers, the 3% militias. Good example is there was a protest in Louisville, Kentucky. And it was a peaceful protest. And people were just marching downtown, going out to the riverfront. And there was at least 150 armed camouflage people with their AR-15s confronting them, getting in the faces of people. And I was like, whoa, that is not the usual five extremely fat guys that I'm expecting to see. This is 150 fat guys and their fat wives with AR-15s. And, well, you know, I make that little joke, but it's a fact. It was becoming this family affair. And these people were not 3% militia. They were new militias, state militias, groups that were forming themselves, these patriot defense leagues of people who were self-appointing to go out and defend places that they weren't asked to ever come to. Perfect example, Kyle Rittenhouse, right? Kyle Rittenhouse was not a militia member. He was not a, you know, part of any of these, you know, Biden resistance organizations. This had turned into almost a social event to where they were like, get your AR-15 and come on out. And we're going to do there's this phrase they like to use called Koreans on the roof. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
During the LA riots for Rodney King, when they had the fighting, some Korean merchants stood on the roof of their buildings with AR-15s. And nobody attacked the buildings. And that has become a white supremacist icon, which is rather ironic. But the icon of the Koreans on the roof, we will stand with our rifles and defend and shoot you. This is why, Kyle Rittenhouse came out.
Yeah.
And they said, we are going to protect this car dealership. Car dealer had no idea they were there, right? The local people had no idea where they were there. The police knew they were there and actually gave them water, said, you guys, you are friendlies, stay in this sector. But the reason I'm describing this event is these were not the groups you were expecting. Those groups had now become a small part of a very large militia movement that I can describe in two words. Trump voters. And that all of those disparate groups had now melded together with Trump voters and were now coming out bringing arms to counter-protest or do whatever they were going to do, defend things.
To stop
weapons.
A miscarriage of justice, to stop the theft of an American election, to...
No, I'm still in George Floyd summer. This is happening 2 months, 3 months before the election.
They are trying to stop the loss of the country. We're losing our American democracy.
Yeah, that's what they say, right?
Right. So
it's like, which part? The McDonald's or the Burger King?
Well, let's go there, right? Because the question of January 6th, as you say, begins a few years earlier, at least this crisis that we're in.
Yeah.
And it's rooted in a sense of loss. Or narrative of loss, right?
Narrative
of loss, yes. Mm. The country is losing something. We're losing what makes us us. Now, we can talk about who the us and the we is and all these conversations. But that's what they're saying.
Right.
When we get to January 6th, which is where your book begins, people are And you begin with a chilling tale of an officer.
Oh, yeah.
A real chilling tale of a police officer whose life is under extraordinary threat mm-hmm. by these protests. Now, in my lifetime, I'm old enough to remember when this crowd was the pro-blue. They're the, you know, we love the police.
Right.
They're the Blue Lives Matter crowd. They're the Law and Order crowd, particularly in a George Floyd summer.
Right.
Right. Right. But suddenly now, they're willing to harm police officers.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
To protect this grander principle of protecting American democracy. At least that's the narrative.
Right.
Because I'm watching your face move.
Right. Yeah.
Talk to me about what that means.
Yeah. Well, the first words of the book are something Officer Mike Fanone, he was being beaten and grasped, and people were grabbing at his equipment.
His Glock, yeah.
And the first words of the book are, kill him with his own gun. And he feels this guy pulling on the holster. You know, those holsters are designed to hold the weapon in, weapons retention. If you don't, like, lift the flap, push it down, twist it a certain way, it won't come out. And this saved his life.
Yeah.
But they were taking his taser off, and they start shocking him in the neck with it, took the magazines off, took his pepper spray off, and he was starting to fall to the ground. And this is what he heard, kill him with his own gun. Now, how did they get from that law and ordered society? How did they get from the thin blue line, we love all cops?
Right.
This is where they have invented their own narrative. And that narrative is, we love you till the moment you get in the way of white people and what they want. And then you are an instrument of the state. You're an instrument of the ZOG, right? The Zionist occupation government. And you... All of these
wow, they
old...
really pack in. They pack in the anti-Semitism, the racism, the misogyny. I mean,
they're an
efficient bunch.
Checklist. These guys literally. It's like someone said, you found an old book on terrorism, extremism in the 20th century, and you said, "Oh my God, look, let's start with the Protocols of Elder Zion in pre-World War I, and let's go on to the Second Revival of the Ku Klux Klan, and the Indian Act, or and there's a chapter on pre-20th century. So let's think about the Scalp Act, where we get pay money for Native Americans' heads, $100 a piece. It's like someone read that book and said, hey, these are good ideas, right? We should start, burning down black, businesses and towns. We should go back to a time where you had to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan to become a sheriff or something like that. It's literally topsy-turvy world. Everything I had ever learned in the history of terrorism, in extremism in the United States, from the Nazi revival in 1935 in New York State, where they actually had a town where all the streets were named after Hermann Göring and Adolf Hitler. And then the America First movement that had their Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden with a giant wall poster of George Washington on one side and Adolf Hitler on the other side and Nazi swastikas everywhere. And it was packed. All of this is having a revival. And as a terrorism professional, it would be akin to me going to an elementary school in Iowa and finding out everyone is now a member of ISIS, right? Everyone believes that they should overthrow the government. It's bizarre what we're seeing in the intelligence community.
Talk to me about that from an intelligence perspective. Well, actually, let me take one step back from a conceptual perspective, and that is to say, you are quite intentional, I think, about using the language of terrorism, the language of counterterrorism, language of insurgency.
Sure.
This is a language that is often exclusively reserved for our conversations about foreign engagement, about violence abroad, about state violence abroad, about conflict abroad, particularly in the geographic and political Middle East. We'll say, oh, there's an insurgency group.
Yeah.
There's been a move to talk about some of the white nationalism as a form of domestic terrorism. But you push that conversation even more forward in this book. Tell me why it was important for you to use that language.
That's a good catch. It was very important because I am a professional in this field. This is like having a surgeon and saying, well, I don't want you to talk about, the medial something or another, right? A technical term in surgery,
Clearly he's not a surgeon.
Not
right?
A surgeon, right? But the people that are doing this are talking like that and swearing they're surgeons, right? But as an intelligence professional, a counterterrorism professional, I don't look at it in terms of race or identity or creed. I look at your tactics, your behaviors, your organization. And let me tell you, I come up with the T word when you act like a terrorist, when you commit acts of political violence or threats of political violence, which are meant to intimidate or extort or influence in an audience beyond the immediate victims who may or may not be killed. Right? You are a terrorist. And so I can use that terminology freely, but it's getting my peers in law enforcement. I'll tell you a quick story. Had a state trooper in upstate New York. I swear to God, this is a true story. We are sitting together, and it turns out I had taught him a terrorism course a few years ago, right? And they don't know my name. They know me as Terrorism Guy, right? And I go, hey, what's up? And he goes, Terrorism Guy. And we're filling our field tags. He goes, listen, that January 6th thing, what do you think about that? I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, was it real? I'm like, they tried to overthrow the United States government. He goes, yeah, but, you know, I see and I hear certain things. And I go, all right, let's put it in a context you understand. You're a state trooper in New York. You are on highway patrol on Route 90. You get a call that says every available gun, report to the state capitol. We are under siege, officers down, people are being shot. Would your blood pressure go up? He goes, yeah. And I go, how fast would you drive? He goes, about 200 miles per hour. I was like, this is what we call an all guns call. Washington, D.C. made that call. 10:13. You can watch the video. 10:13. Officers need assistance. All officers need assistance. We're losing the line. You know how serious that is in cop talk? And I said, imagine now you're in Washington, D.C., and you're a Capitol Hill policeman, and 40,000 people move on your building, and 10,000 are attacking you with spears, poles, mace, chemical, and you know that there's firearms out there. And he goes, okay, I guess I can understand that. I had to bring it to a siege of the state capitol in New York that he would involve himself with.
Right.
And now bring it back out to that. And he's like, yeah, I guess that's a bad thing. I go, it's a bad thing.
You know? That's a bad thing indeed.
But that I had to explain it to him tells us the failure of media. And that the two medias that exist in the United States, the media of the insurgents, right? The media of the people who tried to overthrow the United States government is designed to obfuscate and soften murder, right? Sedition, insurrection, insurgency, and what could arguably be the underpinnings of a civil war. And they'll go, yeah, but Walmart shoppers are doing okay. Their meat prices haven't gone up. And it's like, yeah, but we just, you know, and you know, the next sentence would be, I don't believe that the 300 surface-to-air missiles that were stolen from a National Guard armory are the threat that liberals make it out to be. This is the way they talk. Unfortunately, the talk that I'm reflecting in this book is what we call in the intelligence community eliminationist rhetoric. That is the language that, the last time I heard that phrase was Rwanda. That's the language of Radio Milcolin in Rwanda when they were on air going, kill your neighbors, they're cockroaches, crush the cockroaches, go to any street corner, there are machetes for you, get rid of them, get them out of our society. And you know, they mass murdered a million people that way.
Help me understand how we get here. There's, you talk about, you use the language of revival. Which is, again, an interesting word. It implies almost that something was dead or something was nearly defunct and then something came to stir it up.
Right.
There are other people, though, who believe that it hasn't gone anywhere, that it never went anywhere, that all these people storming the Capitol were the people in their mom's basements on Twitter all this time. They were just hiding and waiting for the moment. And somewhere in between those two narratives, your book sits. Right. You talk about the fact that, yeah, these people exist and they're here. But there's something about this political moment. There's something about, and let me use the phrase you use, which I love. You are you're not always subtle.
Not in this book. No, I was throwing bricks.
The deranged ideology of the orange jihad.
That's a technical intelligence phrase. If I were to actually, No, really. Okay. I want you.
That makes it even funnier then. You realize that doesn't.
I want you to think about this for 1 minute, because we do come up with some very clever phraseology for our strategic intelligence assessments. Yeah. And that little turn of a phrase immediately evokes the knowledge of what I'm talking about, right? The orange jihad, which is what is going on here, which is, you know, I mean, I could have used Caucasian jihad or something like that.
No, orange is perfect.
No, no.
Orange, but this language is why I say it's so important. I mean, if you think about Afghanistan just for a moment, and you think about how there's a withdrawal and suddenly the capital city is taken over immediately, and people say, oh my God, how did this happen so quickly?
Right.
We underestimated how organized the Taliban were.
Right.
We underestimated what had been happening over the previous years leading up to that moment. Oh, it'll take months for them to get there. No, they were there when we left.
Right.
Similarly, people, no one doubted that they were these kinds of people in the world, but we underestimated that January 6th could happen as such and that we'd be as completely unprepared for it as we were. How do you get to a moment like January 6th? What are the things, the kind of almost, maybe not a genealogy, but what if, and you get into this in the book, particularly in the second, third and fourth portions of the book, really in terms of this idea of radicalization, this idea of particularly the QAnon piece. Talk to me about how we get to a moment where something, where this could happen and where these kinds of people get radicalized.
Yeah, the problem is, and I use this in the title of the book, people say, well, they want to kill Americans. And I chose that title like the brick through the glass, right? I really wanted whoever saw this book in a bookstore would have to look at it. Because who's gonna ignore a noose, right, with a phrase, they want to kill Americans? And it's almost a psychological operation. It's almost a information warfare trick where I want you to go, who's they? And the answer is very apparent. They are your neighbors, your neighbors who you would never think about. The plumber who, you know, on occasion comes up and says, yeah, what do you think about Trump? He's awesome, right? But what happened here is we went from radicalized small kernels of extremists in Charlottesville who would come out and, you know, as I analyzed in a previous book, that was their cotillion, all right? The fact that, you know, people were surprised at this turnout in Charlottesville with the khaki pants and the tiki torches. But that came from somewhere, like you said. And to us, we think, oh, that's a 1%. That's a fractional percent. They're a little bit of a kernel. But they got together with neo-Confederates, neo-Nazis, right-wing militias that were coming from multiple parts of the state. And the state police force did nothing when they went on riot. Right? When they were going around beating people, taking out guns, shooting people, running people over with cars. And we keep thinking they're a very small kernel of this bowl of popcorn. Mm. No, they're a cornfield, right? And they just haven't been shucked and taken off and then dried and then popped. And you're looking at that one or two pops of popcorn. And I'm trying to tell you.
Is Trump the corn popper, though?
No, Trump is the fire in the cornfield that has set it on fire from end to end, and everyone pops into a popcorn kernel. And what you have, right, is you have a field ablaze. Everything, the infrastructure is burned. But they think they are now empowered to reconstruct America with the intimidation devices that they have. That's what I call long rifles. They are not weapons. They are not self-defense. They are intimidation tools. Their mere presence is designed to make all of you nervous, right? Wouldn't they make you nervous? You know, a guy rolls out with an AR-15. It's real. That's what it's for. To the inherent underlying threat that I can kill you and your wife and your kids and your dog if you do not satisfy my needs. Donald Trump understood because he, you know, he used to do worldwide wrestling.
Yeah.
And he understood the Walmart shopper. He understood the base person in his society, even though his biggest supporters, we're finding out now from that Washington Post poll, were small business owners who were making $60,000 to $100,000 per year and could afford the bass boat and a second house. That was the real base of his support. But they have decided, you know, these small kernels that we had at the beginning, they're not there anymore. We have a cornfield now. And that cornfield was waiting for a fire, and Donald Trump just took a flamethrower to it, knowing the mayhem it would cause. And he loves mayhem. I've spoken to Michael Cohen. I was on his podcast the other day. His niece, Mary Trump, she's fascinating. And they both say he loves chaos. He loves when an entire organization is fighting amongst itself for him, right? If there had been a mass murder at the Capitol, by the Capitol Hill police, that, and this is something I have to admire.
Which we were close to, based on your book.
Yeah, well, this I have to admire. People say, oh, I can't understand why they just didn't shoot anybody. Mike Fanone said, yeah, I could have drawn my weapon, popped off 15 rounds, I would have hit 15 people. But he said he knew there were dozens of hidden guns out there. Yeah. But he would have forced everyone in the line behind him, 100 officers, to draw and start killing everyone in there, like, you know, this wall of humanity. And they knew what that would be. That would be the end of the United States. Rebellion would have happened that day. Now, the one officer who did actually fire, who understood, the black police lieutenant, who understood what a last barricade was. He had the entire House of Representatives down the hallway from him, right? And he was the only gun between them and these people. And he said, I will defend democracy here and now. And that window, this door, is the red line in the protection of this nation. Wow. And when... You know, the insurrectionist came through the window.
A former Navy woman.
No, Air Force.
Air Force, excuse me.
Former Air Force security woman. Police woman.
I mean, this is fascinating. This isn't just the person who's not, I mean, this person has an investment in America, right? This person this is not the profile that we would imagine.
Yeah, but you're
some of us would
right.
imagine. Right.
But like members of ISIS who were doctors.
Right.
Right? Or who were generals in an armed force and who the next morning, after they're radicalized, they show up at, you know, jihad class wearing a suicide bomb belt. And you go, how does a doctor want to blow himself and other people up? They were radicalized. There is no madrasa here, no fixed school that the right wing got radicalized from. They got radicalized through Fox News and the words of Donald Trump. Nothing else. Really, the words of Donald Trump.
How does this work, though? I mean, we all have TVs, right? We watch Donald Trump and we go, oh, that's the guy from, you know.
The Apprentice.
The Apprentice, right? That's the guy that pretends to be a billionaire. That's the guy with the weird suits, right? I mean, we have our own kind of distance from it. Then other people watch that same narrative, and it resonates with them in a way that makes them want to take up arms. What is it about the conditions, the circumstances, in the book you talk about the psychodynamics of this as well.
Right.
What is it that gets a person to the point that when they hear a weird conspiracy theory, when they hear Donald Trump say the election was stolen, when they say people come down to Kenosha, what makes them do it?
You know, I took a long look at this, and for a very long time, only one word would repeatedly pop into my mind. And it's not a word that we usually see in terrorism, right? It's a word that I usually see amongst warlords, right? Third world potentates, guys who have tiny little fiefdoms carved out of the Central African jungle and where their word is law. And that word is tribalism. I saw Donald Trump as a tribal leader, and that the Republican Party and its followers had decided not to go through organized principles, thought, any of that stuff. It is raw personal emotion. And when they hear the tribal drums beat and their shamans start dancing around the fire, and then the big, fat, slovenly tribal chief comes out, his word is law, but Donald Trump harnessed the power of ignorance. He harnessed the power of promising insane things that he could never promise, but the promise was so sweet, it was like heroin. I will give America back to you, parentheses, dot, 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 white middle-class men who have businesses, who vote for me and love what I say and hate everyone else. That's the parentheses. And he's the master of knowing he doesn't have to say those words. the hint, the wink, and the nod. They loved that. They loved the, you know, he's joshing. He's only joshing when he talks about, you know, killing Negroes and having cops beat them and rough them up when putting in a car. Everybody gets that. You know, people used to say, you know, that it's a dog whistle. No, these are bullhorns. Yeah. Bullhorns. There's no dog whistles anymore. So as a tribal chieftain, he has divided America into two tribes. The white supremacist tribe, where white people will die. And by the way, not you. Okay? They, when I say they view every one of you as a race traitor. That's the phrase they use. And you know where I saw that phrase really used the most? In a book called The Turner Diaries, which Timothy McVeigh read. And when Timothy McVeigh, who, by the way, would be an intern in Marjorie Taylor Greene's office, right, if he had blown up the Murrah building today, Timothy McVeigh actually believed this piece of fiction that if he blew up this bomb, every white cop in America, every white soldier in America would go to the armory, take their weapons out, and kill all the black soldiers and policemen in the country. He believed that that was going to happen. On January 6th, many of those people believed that Donald Trump would overthrow democracy himself, declare himself the king, and they, as a tribe...
Well, in fairness, they didn't think he'd overthrow democracy. They thought that to properly execute democracy, he would have to overturn the election.
Right, well...
I'm just saying, in fairness, I mean, their narrative was, we were cheated.
That's a narrative.
Hugo Chavez!
Right.
Who had died like 14 years prior.
Yeah, 14 years earlier.
Had helped rig the elections. With the Chinese and the machines. But these are the narratives. You talk about people believing myths.
Unfortunately, that narrative is just that. It's a narrative. It's a clever, convenient excuse that they use. Here's the phrase that I like to listen to. A few months before the insurrection, a woman was interviewed on MSNBC, CNN. And she said, I never thought that I'd like a dictator, but if there had to be one, it should be Donald Trump. That's not narrative. That's belief, right? Narrative is the framing, the framework that's set about you that will be the story, which for them is, this is the second 1776. We're having a new American Revolution. We're going to take back government, .. for us white middle-class men who right. voted for Donald Trump. Right. And we are going to reset America that has no diversity, no equality, no women's rights. Right. You can have all the guns that you want and we can say anything about you and do anything about you and do anything to you because we are the dominant tribe.
And they have the guns. Yeah. Talk to me about the guns, the military or really the paramilitary movements. And your book is a wonderful sort of outline, not just of the current moment, but of the kind of waves of paramilitary sort of intervention into our society. Talk to me about how important the paramilitary piece of this is.
Oh, it's insane. I'm a gun collector, all right? I have a lot of firearms, but I collect them. And here's what I don't do that these people do. I do not lie in my bed with them. And caress them.
You don't date them, right?
And call them Shirley, right? I'm not joking. These guys, I understand. I was a professional military person. I was an intelligence officer, career intelligence officer. I worked in the worst places in the world. These are training tools for me. They are just really highly specialized hammers. And I never look at them or touch them until I need a hammer for a short period of time to practice hammering. These people buy these weapons now. The massive explosion of firearm sales because they now believe that they are going to be empowered to overthrow American government.
They believe half of their American citizens are nails.
Yeah. That's you're all nails.
Yeah.
You know, like the guy said in that Charlie Kirk speech in Oregon, when are we going to do... I got a question. When are we going to be able to use our guns? This man feels that because he has the hammer, it must be used. I didn't buy this gun
just to clean it and shoot it on occasion. These people now believe and they want to kill Americans, your neighbors, they want to use those firearms because it doesn't have talismanic effect. It can only have murderous effect. Yeah. And here's the worst part, all right, because I'm over in Ukraine. When you start shooting a firearm and you get the smell of the cordite from that power, you get two feelings. The first one is, you know, maybe, am I doing this properly? That's the first thought that you have. And the second thought that you have after you shot for a while is, I need to maintain my proficiency and get better at this. That's how professionals think. These guys are thinking, I can shoot him, I can shoot her, I can, when they're sitting there watching things, I could shoot Nancy Pelosi, I could do this, I can do that. They are viewing this as not a training tool or a tool for the defense of your farm against coyotes. They are thinking about mass murdering you. And what they do is they use modern TV tropes. The Walking Dead is a good one, right? Zombie. Train on zombies. Do Call of Duty Modern Warfare Zombie Edition. They have zombie load ammunition. They have zombie incident response team stickers. You know who the zombies are? In a crisis in the world that they call world without rule of law, some crisis, natural disaster, blacks, minorities, and liberals who come up from the hinterlands from that emergency into your town are to be treated like zombies. Mm. And they think they are going to have to shoot you like the zombies in the TV show The Walking Dead. Don't believe a word I say. Go read their stuff. They say that. Oh, the zombies are going to come someday. So we had an incident of that just a year ago. There was a fire that took place in Oregon State. Two liberal bloggers had put out that they were going to go look at these fires, and this rumor that the liberals and Antifa were coming and setting all these wildfires, a whole effing town armed itself, set up roadblocks all the way around the city, and then at gunpoint arrested and took into custody these two people just bebopping through the town. And the police had to come. Do you think they disarmed them?
No. Of course not.
They said, you guys could put your guns away and go on home and let these people go, right? As opposed to, I'm going to give you to the count of three. If you're a black person, they won't give you to the count of three, right? They will detect, acquire, engage.
Yeah.
So that is where we are with regards to the paramilitary. These are not trained people. These are what we call MWRs, men with rifles, you know? And they have now combined themselves in the belief that their masculinity, their manpower, their humanity, their ability to be one of the King Leonidas's 300, right, from the movie 300, they worship that film like it is a documentary for them, you know? Not one of them has one ab, right? There's like 7,000 abs in the movie 300. These guys, big, fat, you know, with, you know, guys who have this, who now they grow out the special forces beard. That's what I call it, right? I just didn't have time to shave. But they take these images and these popular things that they see, like the relaxed grooming standard of the Navy SEALs or special forces in Afghanistan. Donald Trump Jr. did this. Ted Cruz did that. They now grow their beards out for this. You know, embrace of masculinity that they could never, ever, ever have. And when in the epilogue, in the audiobook epilogue, I actually have 2,000 additional words. And I'm sitting in Ukraine, and I'm describing all the armor and equipment that I have to put on to go to battle. And when I describe after three paragraphs, you're like exhausted, hand grenades, blah, 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 blah. I go, on January 6th, These quote-unquote American quote-unquote patriots put on the exact same equipment to take down and destroy American democracy and to make Donald Trump a king. Literally George the Fourth, if we're going to get technical about it, or King Donald the First. They were willing to destroy the American experiment. And we're all Philadelphians here, right?
boy, when I give my little speeches out there and I talk about Philadelphia and how I get offended, deeply, deeply offended. I go, you're going to screw up everything that was written at 5th and Chestnut, right? You're going to set fire to the concept of America that is progressive, that's made progress. And as far as they're concerned, they've only made progress in firearms and oppressing people. But all of that, you know, all of the belief that America is equal and diverse and you should have opportunity, that only applies to them. Everyone else is to be a second-class citizen. And that's apartheid. This is a minority that now wants to dominate 35% of the country that wants to dominate the other 65%. And they will rule over you, not with you.
We have time for questions. I have about, just so you know, I'm not like ordering like lunch over here. I got about four questions from Twitter as we're here. So I want to
Let's rapid fire these things.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to do one and then go here and then we'll come back because since you all actually came out to this wonderful. But one person says, how do we read this book, accept your analysis, and still have hope? Now, I find this question actually quite funny because at the
ruin the end of the book.
I won't ruin the book, but I'll just say, you know what? I won't ruin it. But I'll just talk to me about how where hope lies in all of your analysis.
Yeah, it doesn't. No. There's some.
I mean, that's kind of what you do to me at the end of the book. I'm kind of like.
You know what? I deliver. You know, every one of my other books, I have this lofty, spiritual, almost like a statuesque embrace of the American experiment. Every one of my other books, my ISIS book had this in it, right?
That's why I thought I had a chance. I got to the last chapter.
Last words.
I was waiting to be inspired, and he's like, no, you're kind of
screwed. I said, screw it. You're all getting it wrong. No, I decided I am not going to pull any more punches here. I need to make you afraid. I need to make you fear, not for your life, but for your life as Americans, where the word American means what it's been meaning forever. These people want the America of 1867, when the first Ku Klux Klan dominated the South, would intimidate anyone, white, black, northerner, southerner, who crossed them. And you know what it took to eliminate the first Klan? Ulysses Grant's army. We actually had a counterinsurgency in the United States where we jailed almost literally every elected official in the South. They were all Klansmen. They were running a clandestine clandestine insurgency of masked armed men who were not just intimidating blacks, but they were shooting, you know, anybody who came from the government. And they ruthlessly put them down until the Supreme Court ruled that they couldn't do that. But they eliminated the Klan for almost 30 years, eliminated it. But, you know, their kids got nostalgia for it. So what hope is there? Not really. There were three revivals of the Klan, and now we're on the fourth, you know? And it's not the Klan anymore. It's being a Republican Party member. No, really.
Well, actually, that actually is. Then I want to go to your question.
Can I answer that hope part?
Yes, yes, okay. Yes, please.
I hope you vote. There you go. It's the only tool this nation was built on. It's the only weapon that really works. And you know what they hate? Massive out turnout of votes. They want their minority vote to turn out 100%, but your majority vote that could wash them away with 200%. They want you steeped in apathy and fear and the belief that they are more powerful than you. You're far more powerful than them because you outnumber them 3-1. But they want two of you not voting, and they want one of you to lose your right to vote. So I hope you vote.
Powerful. Yeah, we'll go right here.
Militias that you were talking about. You know, we heard about the Proud Boys and, you know, the other one.
Oath Keepers, yeah.
And are there others?
Yeah.
And in what states
There's
are they?
There's three chapters of them. They're everywhere. I'm going to tell you right now, there's militias here in Philadelphia. All right, there are militias, definitely militias out in the surrounding suburbs. They don't call themselves militias. What they call themselves is like gun groups and patriot leagues, and these are the guys who get together out in some farm field. But they're talking, but they call themselves, you know, armed patriots. You know, they are not talking about armed patriots in the sense of the American Revolution going up against, you know, a tyrannical foreign power. They're talking about their definition of armed patriotism is subjugating you with lethal force. And that is, all of you who are, for those of you, again, who are white here, they have a special day for you that was written again in the Turner Diaries, the Day of the Rope. And that was supposed to be a day where race traitors and collaborators and cooperators with the enemy and the Jews and the Negroes, they were going to find you on the street, throw a noose around your neck, and hang you from the post. I have seen people say that that is what January 6th was going to be. It will be the day of the rope. So they want to kill Americans. They have this in their head. But for every one guy out of 100, he's the guy that will get the other 99 to do it.
Thank you for being here. I'll try to be brief, but you probably already know I talk too much. And this may not be in your book, but you probably know the next term, the Supreme Court will rule, I guarantee it, 5-4, that Trump is president. What they're going to say is in North Carolina, basically, the state legislature, which easily happened in Pennsylvania, can overrule the will of the people and declare an alternate state of electors. And so on January 6th of 2025, I guess it would be Kamala Harris in the same spot that Mike Pence would be in, except she'd have to actually overthrow the government. My point is that it seems like you're worried about Trump, which I am, and Republicans. My concern is that some future could be DeSantis, it could be anybody, could right. be in the same situation. And my concern is the people, they're brilliant people for 1787 or 91 or 76, you know, a couple blocks from here. They really tried to make a democracy that would work. But as you know, famously, Ben Franklin said, a republic, if you can keep it. My concern is it's not just Trump or something, is that this whole thing can fall apart very easily.
Yeah, I think we right. I think we got the spirit right. of your
so
question.
I don't know what we can do about that, but if you have any ideas, let us know.
Well, yeah, I've got some great ideas of what you can do about that. This November is a referendum on whether America should exist anymore. Every one of you needs to use that phrase. It is a vote on whether you want America to exist the way it's existed for 245 years now. And if you say, no, I don't want it to exist the way that it's exists, you better think about what that means. We've already just taken one big step to the Handmaid's Tale, right? I said this on a radio program today. One of my favorite segments of The Handmaid's Tale was that flashback to the happier times where she goes to work and her boss says, all of you women, take these boxes, take your personal effects, line up behind these armed men and leave the building. And they go, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? And he goes, well, you've been ordered, no longer allowed to work. And the woman says, when did that happen? And he said, when they passed the vote. And she said, what vote? Yeah, what vote? You don't even pay attention to what's happening to you, all right? The vote was you can't work. Armed militias will now, who are men, will escort you home, and you are about to be governmentally raped, all right, because of fall of something that caused a fall in the birth control. And you weren't smart enough to watch it. And the next scene is when they're all out in the street, we don't want to be raped. And the National Guard comes out and they just slaughter everyone. Too late for you to say, what vote? Right? This is not where we want to go. And as an intelligence professional, I have to game that one out too, just to be sure. Are we going to move in that direction? Well, no. This November is when you're going to make that decision. And don't vote for yourselves. I know every one of you in here votes. Go find 5 or 10 people that you know that don't vote. Create a voting block, an education block. We have a neat trick that happened in New York 19, where I live. We have a black congressman named Anthony Delgado. And we have an overwhelmingly Republican county there. I don't know how he won. I think it's 93% white, 57% Republican. But the previous congressman was a guy named Faso. So the Indivisible Group, for fun, started holding Faso Friday. They would go to his office. The guy hadn't gone to his office in 3 years. And they would just have a small block party in front of his office. Pizza party, handing out pizza and cake and stuff to people. Just being really nice. It became this massive Friday event. Everybody would come out, 100, 200 people. People would just drive by to see what kind of cake or pizza they were giving out, right? And it became a social event for the county. And it waved Delgado into power. Because everyone was now interested in the politics and the social aspects of the politics. Their social aspects are getting together with guns and thinking about mass murdering other Americans. And I'm not joking. They say it themselves. Everything I write in that book comes from their Twitter feed, their chats. I don't have to lie about any of this. They tell you because they want you to know, to be intimidated. Hmm.
Yeah, you have argued that this is almost like a grassroots movement that was, and the fire was set by Donald Trump. But what about the role of the billionaires, the oligarchs who are funding a lot of these so-called nonprofit groups, purposely to set up these people?
That's an interesting question.
Are they not leading this charge?
Yeah, first off, does anybody know any liberal billionaires in here? All right, because I need $50,000 for night vision. But the second part of this question, my question is, we don't have billionaires like they have billionaires. Our billionaires are either neutral and trying to balance out their donation or trying to be, they're not like them. Sheldon Adelson.
They're also baby billionaires. They're like the 1.7. The Jay-Z billionaire is very different than the.
That's right. And they ain't giving away their money.
Right.
They're not giving their money. Sheldon Adelson, before he died, he gave $100 million in one sitting. He bought a president. He bought a Presidential Medal of Freedom for his wife. And it was all acceptable, right? They understand you buy power. If you want an effect, you want Israel to, the United States to move the embassy to Israel, you buy the guy from Israel to Jerusalem, you buy the guy that will do that, and you will be seen throughout history as the guy who put the fix in. They buy their effect. This is like old school Tammany Hall level corruption, but it's so much money, you can't track it. We thought it was all the Koch brothers and dark money. No, it's in your face, middle finger, here's $250 million, go get the effect, make America what I want it to be. And now we're getting, a good example of that's Elon Musk, right? Elon Musk is clearly out of his effing mind. No, I'm going to do an analysis of Elon Musk. That is a technical intelligence analysis, a psychological analysis. I had to categorize him. I would, and I had to write the cover title for my top secret analysis. It would be Elon Musk, the new Bond villain. He is. His ideology went from making money to where he now hates all things liberal. And, if I was the president of the United States, I'd be going, we're going to cancel all your NASA contracts. You are fundamental. You sell it, you get rid of it, or we're just going to break you financially. You do not believe in America. Well, why should he? He's a white South African who made money with a handful of illegal diamonds he bought illegally into the United States and sold illegally on the diamond market of New York City. And we think he's a genius. He's not a genius. He bought every company that he has when it was at its peak and now thinks he's, what they say? You hit a triple and you think you were born on third. Or you're born on third, thought you hit a triple. Yeah. Right? No, Elon Musk is the new model of funding hatred. He's got his little new World War I Hitler cowlick he's wearing. Right? Like Hitler when he was a painter. This is really bizarre.
I could not even have imagined that my peers in U.S. intelligence, no, let me rephrase that, British intelligence are going, you know, writing reports, the United States, unbalanced or just strictly out of its mind. That's probably a real analysis that someone at MI6 has to write.
Wow.
And they're not going to laugh at that title. That's real.
Mine's is short because I follow politics.
Uh-huh.
And truth is relative. But I am incredulous. How can these people, I don't want to call them dumb, but I'm like, duh. Like, you can't see right what's right in front of your face. I know you talked about tribalism. But when I see some of the comments and the responses, I'm scratching my head. Like, you, all I can think of is bleep, 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 you are a sheep.
Yeah.
And how do we get to that point?
So, I mean, and this goes back to, I mean, you give an example in the book of a guy who's literally driving down the road about to do harm to his kids potentially because he's trying to save them from Hillary Clinton, who's supposed to be like a child predator. I mean, there's this whole,
Hillary Clinton's going to drink your blood.
Right.
Hillary Clinton's getting adrenochrome out of this guy kidnapped his kids.
I mean, so there's like that extreme. Then there's the, I believe that the voting machines have been all tainted. I mean, there's a spectrum here. But to your, to just to amplify the question a bit, like how do you, how does this happen? How does someone get to that state? Everyone's not mentally ill.
No. No. But, you know, this is one, you know, I'm supposed to be interviewed by Mary Trump tomorrow. I will put this to her because she's a psychologist. And what is it? I think the word you used there was very good. Spectrum. And I don't mean it's like on the autistic spectrum. I mean, this is these people across their entire tribe have wildly diverse ideas, which are patently and unincredulously conspiracy theory. But now they've gotten to the point where to be acceptable and in that tribe, you must believe conspiracy theory X, Y, and Z. And then you can come in and add your own conspiracy theory and other people will accept you. So it's this sort of reinforcement of bizarre ideas. And look, many a PhD thesis is going to be written about this, you know, so you should start yours right now. I'll come defend it.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you your question, and then this person right here will get their question as well. I'm going to ask you to ask both these questions now, and then you can answer them just to save time, all right? And I think I'm feeling some synergy between your questions. I can feel it in the air. So this will work out brilliantly. Go ahead.
Okay.
Malcolm, thank you for being here. One of the things that disturbs me is the large amount of retired military folks and former peace officers who are in this quote-unquote movement. And when I talked to my fellow retirees, I said, how can you support a guy who never in four generations was ever in the military? And they just look at me, and their eyes kind of roll back. And then a few months ago,
So is your question about the military? I don't mean to cut you off, but we
have... But I was just going to talk about the police. When I saw the demonstrators physically in South Philly trying to protect the statue, carrying AR-15s and golf clubs, and the police were talking with them, you know, joking with them, I was just kind of worried about that. And I wondered if you kind of... And this happened in Philly.
Right. Hey, when did the Frank Rizzo statue get taken down? Didn't they have an event?
Oh yeah,
around that a couple of years
ago. Event is a good
ago?
Word for it. Yeah. I'm gonna get this question, and then so you can answer both because we're actually at the hour. But I did promise this. I have asked
me at the signing.
I'm a man of my word. I will allow you to also get yours, and then the synergy is gonna be extraordinary. You'll be stunned by the way this connects. Go ahead.
So, military.
So I apologize. I have not read your book. But I am wondering if you have any comment on the role of religiosity in all of this.
Oh, yeah.
This is good.
Yeah, you know what? I'd hate to be the one to say. I want to pop these two answers off really quick.
As soon as President Trump, longtime listener, big fan. Thank you, Mel. And as soon as Trump was elected president, the first thing I did after the first year was I looked up a quote. And I think this quote captured what was going on. And I'll tell you who the quote is from when I get done. I'll tell you what's at the bottom of this. If you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice that you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on, and he'll even empty his pockets for you.
Yeah.
Lyndon Baines Johnson.
So this is an interesting connection here in terms of the motivations for how we get here, whether it's religion, whether it's the people, because often the people doing that are often pushing to the military. What, talk to me quickly about the this sort of thread here.
Well, I mean, the military, one in four of the insurrectionists were former military or active duty military. Active duty U.S. Marine Corps colonel was the first one through the window and opened the doors for people, thinking what? That his oath meant nothing? Here's the problem that I have as a member who served in the armed forces 20 years, the intelligence community for 15 more years. My family has served nonstop. Since April 1864, there has been a Nance in the armed forces.
Damn.
And how come...
He wasn't even free yet.
I know. Well, that's correct. That's correct. Two of them ran away from slavery in Northern Alabama and joined the 111th U.S. Colored Troops. They weren't even free
made
yet.
A left.
But you know what? Better than Alabama, right?
Touché.
So, but that being said... I think we don't talk to them correctly. I do in the way I write, in the way I speak out there. I don't say, hey, man, what's going on with you with this Trump thing? Right? I go, explain to me why you're a traitor. Explain to me why that oath you took, you have spat on it, you have torn it up. I should kick your ass right now for betraying this nation. And I want to evoke a response. I'm not a traitor. Explain to me why you were protecting and being with the enemies of our nation. I'm not with the enemies. I'm a patriot. No, right now, you are a terrorist. You are an insurrectionist. You're no better than Robert goddamn E. Lee after he left West Point. Talk to them that way and see if you can evoke the belief that they should have, what do you call it, maintained the oath that they took. They do not like that. And regarding religion, I wrote a book called The Plot to Destroy Democracy, which was about Putin. And it talks about how the Russians co-opted the evangelical movement. They pretty much bought it out over 10 years with these defense of Christianity conferences they were holding in Moscow, to the point where Franklin Graham is a good friend of Vladimir Putin. And the Russians studied us for 80 years, and they took everything they knew and they exploited us when they had enough money and we wanted their money. We would do anything. The evangelicals would go over there all the time and get money from Moscow. So all of that led as a base of the Trump tribe. Evangelicals all believe like 90% the election was stolen and that insurrectionists are all innocent. You know, like Jesus Christ wanted, right? Oh, Christ, your question, I can't recall. What was it?
It was more of a statement about the sort of the Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah, we had talked about that.
We literally talked about
that
in the back,
when we were saying that quote, because a lot of people, this is race. It's race, your religion, and your uterus. Those are the three major factors here. If you got a race, you got a uterus, and you have a religion other than theirs, and you do not agree with them politically, you are the enemy. And I have a chapter in this book where I go over all the categories of enemies historically by these people. And you know who gets it the worst besides the Native American Indians? The Jews. And they think the Jews control everything. 1 week or 2 weeks after the Capitol insurrection, they found a Capitol Hill policeman reading a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a book that said that the Jews run the financial world, a false document written up in pre-World War I Russia. And he wasn't studying it for a terrorism course. This was like, hey, John, why don't you read this good book about how the Jews run everything? We just had an insurrection over that. Right. It is solid QAnon belief that Jews
reinforced by Trump.
Everything. Reinforced by Trump. My God. We are in a crazy, crazy world.
And in that crazy, crazy world, we have some insights, some analyses. This book is one of them. It is called They Want to Kill Americans, The Malicious Terrorists and Deranged Ideology of the Trump Insurgency. I promise you, it is a wonderful book. It is an extraordinary read. It's powerful. It's well-researched. The writing dances on the page. I strongly encourage everyone to read it, engage it. You may not agree with all of it, but you'll love it. And it's a part of the real vigorous work that we have in our society of keeping this democracy going, of challenging ourselves to be better, and of making sure this November we're armed not just with our votes, but with the proper information to make an informed vote.
Absolutely.
All of that comes from this book. Malcolm, I'm so grateful for you. Thank you so much for this book, and thank you so much for hanging out with me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.